Well, I'm not going to say welcome, Queens, to the Body Love Binge because, well, welcome to the Body Love Binge if you're listening to it on my podcast. But Julia, you're here too. So do you want to welcome your listeners as well?
Welcome to Fly to Freedom and the Body Love Binge, because we're
Thank
doing a
you.
collaboration today, which is exciting.
Very exciting. If you don't know who each of us are, you should, why not, basically.
Exactly. Why not? We've been on each other several times. You should know. Come on.
Exactly. Today, what was our title we came up with? The shit. Go on, say it.
No one talks about.
In eating disorder recovery.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to dive in? The first thing.
Yeah, sure. Well, when I started recovery, I was searching and searching and searching for information on all the weird symptoms I was having. And there's so much nobody talks about. And one thing I was concerned about doing this episode because I don't want to scare anyone off from recovery because these symptoms, yeah, they're not great. They're not nice. And I mean, recovery is hard, isn't it? But even with all these symptoms, it is like a million, billion, trillion percent worth it. Like, don't let it put you off because it's the smallest price to pay for the freedom. So, well, one of my biggest symptoms was edema. I just swelled up and stayed swollen. Bloody ages, honestly. Just it was awful. It felt like it almost felt like my body was punishing me to begin with. It was like, okay, so we're just gonna make you big immediately. And that was so hard to cope with and painful, physically painful, very uncomfortable. And I mean, the reason we get edema, not everyone gets it. It's really not everyone. And some people get it for a couple of days, some people get it for a couple of weeks. Me, I had it for a long time.
Yes, months.
Yes. But we get it for a couple of reasons, and that is to enable the cells to move around the body much more easily to start all the repair work. And also for me, it really was my body saying, sit the fuck down. I'm going to make it impossible for you to move because you've got to rest so that the repair work can happen. So, yeah, edema was a really big one for me.
So it made you tired as well as in pain.
Yes, yeah, and exhaustion was actually another one I was going to cover.
Yeah, well, let me speak to my little bit about my experience with edema. It was different to yours, but I did experience it. So we'll just share our points and each of us can just speak off the back of that. So for me, it's because my story is a bit different in terms of those that don't know, I was anorexic as a teenager for a few years, and then mine morphed into bulimia and binge eating. So I didn't start recovery actually until I was 30 years old, but I did, thankfully. My body was fighting for life, so I did have the binges, but then I would compensate for them through bulimia behaviors. And so when I had the edema, it would only last days for me after massive binges. So then I would then restrict again, so it would gradually go away again. And then this happened for what's from the age of, so I was anorexic from the age of around 11. And then I was quote in quote weight restored from anorexia, which I wasn't, because I was still underweight for my weight. For the next 15 years, I just binge, purge, restrict, binge, purge, restrict. So the edema was like every time I had a binge, my ankles would swell up and it would just look like a cankle, like both can it would be like both cankles and my face. And I can see it in photos now, like from when I look back, like my face was really round and puffy. And my tummy, I used to eat so much, and this is probably not edema, but this I want to speak to this part. I used to eat so much in my binges that the next day my tummy was physically sore because I'd physically stretched the pouch of my stomach.
Wow.
Yeah, I used to eat so much that I literally couldn't breathe, and I'm not exaggerating. Like if I walked, it like I couldn't breathe because I was so full.
Yeah, I get that. With the face, where you were saying, with your face swelled up, in the mornings, my face was really, really puffy. And this is one of the reasons I knew it was edema and that I hadn't just gained so much weight in a case of a couple of days. It's during the day, it just sort of like went down my body.
Yeah, interesting.
It was very tight. My skin felt very, very, very tight and sore everywhere. Couldn't wear my rings.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I've had a few clients say to me, you know, my rings don't fit me, my clothes don't fit me. And yes, weight gain, depending on where you are and your natural set point weight in recovery, I mean, anorexics usually are very, very underweight for their body weight. Weight gain is almost inevitable. So it's not just the weight, it's the swelling to start with, isn't it? That stops things.
Yeah, I couldn't wear socks for months because they hurt.
Yeah, but you persevered.
Absolutely, and it's like 1,000,000% worth it. So worth it.
Yeah. Let's go on to the exhaustion then, which came for you with the edema.
Yes. Now, that actually really quite scared me, because in the eating disorder, I was so busy, and I seemed to have this, what I now know is false energy from like stress hormones and coffee, I think.
Yeah.
Where I would be up at the crack of dawn and be on my feet and busy and doing until late at night. And in recovery, I expected to get more energy because I was eating, because I was fueling my body. And I used to have to lie down after a shower. I was so tired. Just, I could do nothing. I was like, I felt like a sloth. I just like was on the sofa. And that really, really confused me. And scared me. And I thought, well, have I completely broken my body? Like, totally. But again, it's all about healing, isn't it? It's all about resting so your body can heal.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up the before recovery, because you're like on a high. It's like you don't get sick. It's like you have this weird superpower where you don't need to be a human. You don't need food. You don't need to be like a human being. You just skinny, so everyone's praising you. And this isn't I do want to speak to atypical anorexia, and I've done an episode on that purely, whereas people can have anorexia without being skinny, in quotes. But it's like you're not a human. Do you know what I mean by that? It's like you can just keep going.
Yeah, it was like a superpower, and certainly in the early days I felt like I had a superpower, but it was almost like a compulsive superpower, though, that I had to keep going, even though I kind of did feel exhausted. I felt like I was compelled to keep going. I had to keep doing all the time. So when the exhaustion hit in recovery, that was, it was hard to take. It was really hard to take, but it was actually a really good thing, and to learn to sit, which I never did before.
Because you had no choice. Like you say, the edema and the exhaustion was basically like, well, good luck actually doing your old behaviours then.
Yeah.
Thanks, buddy. Yes.
In a way, I'm actually really, really grateful to it, because it was because I was so compelled to move. I'd been doing so much exercise and stuff. It was like the choice had been taken from me. I had to do what my body told me to do. Mm. And that I am grateful for, because it was, I suppose, no willpower required on that.
You just had to, you were forced to surrender to your body and to recovery.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I want to speak to the migration response with what you were sharing before you started the recovery. And I remember it well as well. So it's that almost like an infinite energy, even though it's a compulsion because you have to keep going, but you somehow have the energy to keep going. The way the migration response works, of course, as you know, this is for the listeners, is when the anorexia gene is triggered and you're underweight for your body weight. Back in the day, when we were having to move from land to land in order to keep finding food and to survive, those with the anorexia genetics are actually survivors, because when the genes switched on, your body and your biology drives you to eat less, move more, eat less, move more, eat less, move more, to get to a land with more food, so then you survive. if you were too busy having hunger signals, and if you were too hungry and you just had to go and find food, you could die if you weren't moving enough and quick enough to get to a different land. So that is definitely the reason why I believe, I don't know what your thoughts are on that, as to why with no food, hardly any food, with no nourishment, you do seem to have this weird energy to keep going somehow.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I also think that the anxiety is linked into that as well, because many, many years ago, when you were moving from place to place, when famines arrived and stuff, you had to be totally alert to any dangers around to keep yourself alive.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why I certainly had such increased anxiety all the time, because my brain was just searching for danger the whole time. And I think that's part of the migration response as well. That's my thoughts on it anyway.
Totally agree, because starvation is a trauma response for the body.
Yeah.
As well. Yes. So not getting enough food is like a trauma response. And what you said, you have to be on high alert. So it's all of it combined, which can be a shit show. And we have the power to change that.
Yes, we do.
I want to go into, she's going to laugh at what I've written here, digestion issues, so much farting around and wind.
Oh my God, yeah, horrendous. Just, I mean,
I want to speak to that.
It was bad.
When you start eating again, your body needs time to get you, even though your body wants the food, obviously, your body is so smart and it's very, here we go again. I always lose a word. It's very effective, efficient. There we go. So when you're not eating because of said migration response or whatever, your body starts to adapt to that and not, it doesn't produce enzymes for gluten or lactose, for example, when you've not had it for however many years, because it's not going to waste energy producing that when it doesn't need it. And at the same time, it needs the food. So when we start eating again, it can feel like, oh, I'm allergic to gluten, I'm allergic to dairy, I shouldn't eat this, it's easier to restrict because this is horrible. I'll let you talk about your experience, because you, again, mine was different, because I kept splits and splurts. I was eating a lot and then restrict. So I gained weight very slowly over time, but you just went full on in. So yours was more heightened. Do you want to speak about your experience with that?
Oh, what, living in the loo?
Basically, yes.
Literally everything I ate, everything went straight through me. I eat and then I'm on the toilet. And I remember saying to you, what is the point in eating? It's literally coming straight out. I could not even finish chewing a mouthful before I was on the loo.
Wow.
And at that point, I didn't dare fart. Would have been good. But it was worth persevering, because it wasn't that I was allergic to all the foods, like every food. It wasn't that my body could no longer digest. It just had to have time to relearn how to do all that digesting.
Yeah. And my experience was, oh, sorry, go on.
I was going to say, I've also got clients that are completely the opposite, and just because they're so slow, they don't go at all, really. And again, it's a case of the body getting used to digesting food again.
That's what I was going to say. My experience was a lot of constipation. And because we have that delayed gastric emptying, because that's what happens when you restrict, your body like tries to use every single tiny morsel of food that you put into it and get every nutrient out of it, because there's not enough coming in. So for me, when I did start recovery, I was constipated a lot. So that was horrible, because obviously, until you rewire this, you have a fear of anything being inside you anyway. And so when it wasn't coming out, it was like, oh my God, like I'm eating all this. Like, where is it? What's it doing?
Another thing related to eating that I found, which again, I was quite worried about and didn't know what happened, was about half an hour after eating, I felt like I was on fire. My whole body was boiling hot and I was sweating. And considering I'd spent the last 40 years freezing cold, it was the weirdest thing ever. And I was like, what's going wrong? Why am I doing this? again, it's just as your digestion starts kicking in, your metabolism starts ramping up to try and digest all the food and use the food and send it to the right places. And that creates heat.
Yeah, like a furnace. Like when you put wood on the fire gets brighter and burns quicker.
Yeah, absolutely. Really good analogy, that one.
Yeah. And I'm imagining myself trying to start a fire in this little cottage that we stayed in. I couldn't. But when the fire starts, it's easier to keep it going. But like in recovery, when you start eating and you've mentioned that hotness that you felt, it's simply your body turning everything on again.
Yeah.
Fuel to actually do human stuff. So it can can feel all sorts of kind of crazy as well. But I think, yeah, I think speaking to the digestion issues, because again, we're not doctors. I am a nutritionist, but either way, personal experience, in my opinion, is more powerful. People get, so let's say a month or so into recovery and then worried that they're lactose intolerant or have celiac disease from gluten. And we're not saying you don't, but we are saying persevere. Because, because didn't you say something to me a couple of months into recovery, should I have a food intolerance test or something? And I said, absolutely not, because that's just not going to benefit recovery. And then now you're fine.
Yes. Yeah. Now I'm absolutely fine. There are things that my body doesn't like if I have too much of now, like too much chocolate makes me actually really hot and unable to sleep. But I can have some. Made sure of that.
Oh well, thank God I haven't got that problem. I'd never sleep.
But yeah, all the stuff that I didn't think I could digest, I can.
Yeah.
And a lot of the stuff I didn't think I liked as well.
Yeah, that's true. Because the eating disorder convinces us almost to the point that we believe it, that we don't like something. But give me an example of what you found that you do like now.
Bread.
Bread. Yes, I love bread.
I really like bread. And I told myself that I didn't like bread. And I believed I didn't like bread. And pizza. I believed I didn't like pizza.
Wow. I'm glad you've come to your senses now.
Yeah. I still don't like cake, though.
No, you don't. The texture.
Yeah.
For me, I pretended, or actually convinced myself, I didn't like mayonnaise. So if ever I had a dip, it would be like, you know, the low calorie tomato sauce dip. But now I love mayonnaise. But it was a fear for so long. And it wasn't until I actually moved to the Netherlands, which is when I started recovery anyway. Wouter, my now husband, eats mayonnaise with like everything. I think it's a Dutch thing as well. And I was still a bit, I could feel like my panic watching him eat so much of it. And then as I started recovery, I was like, what's all that about? Why do I feel panicky watching someone else eat mayonnaise? And of course, it's the fat content and what that meant to me. And so to challenge that, you just have to do the opposite of what your fear tells you to do. And I just kept eating it. And now I actually really enjoy it.
Yeah. But I mean, there were some foods that I knew were fear foods, like chocolate, but I had literally convinced myself that I didn't like.
Yeah, the taste.
Yeah, and that wasn't true.
Yeah.
So it's definitely worth keeping on trying foods that you've told yourself you don't like.
Yeah, that's true.
Not just once.
Yes, and persevere with, again, we're not doctors, but I've got in my head like a time scale of at least 6 months of full, total, unrestricted eating before you start to look at, okay, maybe my body doesn't like X, Y, and Z. Would you say that time scale as well?
Yeah, I would. I'd say if you get quite a strong reaction to something, don't eliminate it, but maybe have it in a smaller quantity so your body can get used to it rather than hitting it with loads at once.
Yeah, that's a good point for sure. Yeah. And I want to speak, as we're on digestion, because I had a lot of acid and heartburn. The second I started eating a lot of carbs, it was constant acid for weeks. And that was really shit.
Yes, I did. Yeah, that was horrible.
Yeah. And it just eventually just goes, doesn't it?
Faded away. Yeah, very much so.
And you can take medication like heartburn tablets to support yourself with that. I mean, being like a holistic person, I wouldn't recommend that like ultimate, like indefinitely. If it's continuous after a year, I'd take a look at it, you know, a bit deeper. But especially as you're going through recovery, anything that you can take to help you with the symptoms, I need to take. Thanks for joining in too.
I always love to join in on a podcast.
So I used to take heartburn tablets for the acid that I used to get whenever I used to eat carbs until my body was like, and I think what you said about the migration response plus anxiety, I think this is incorporated with how my body dealt with carbs, because I used to be so anxious about eating them. Your body is a physical manifestation of what's going on mentally and emotionally, isn't it? So if I was afraid and stressed about eating chocolate and bread and carbs, then my body thinks something's wrong and will react accordingly. So your mind is so powerful.
Yeah, I still get that to this day. If I'm anxious or worried or upset about something, I will have a bad stomach. Nothing to do with food I eat or anything like that. It's anxiety and emotions that cause it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So
smart. And going on food, so my body now, I have a really good relationship with my body, and I eat tomatoes and I eat tomato-based sauces, but when I do, I've got so much TMI, so much wind, my body just does not enjoy tomato stuff at all, which is interesting. But because I've got that connection with her, I can then choose whether to avoid, well, I don't even like them much, to be honest. So I think my body communicates and it makes it easier for me not to eat them. But whenever I have literally like even two cherry tomatoes, I know about it.
Wow. You have that with avocados as well, don't you?
And avocado, I stay... Well, with avocado, I'm in physical pain. Like, I literally have to lie down. I couldn't do a coaching call. It's weird.
Yeah.
Really weird. That's why when I came to stay with you, I think you asked me, is anything I don't like to eat? And I was like, I like anything apart from avocados, and I'm not keen on tomatoes.
Yeah.
I just raided your chocolate stash instead every night. I want to go in. Go on.
I was just going to say, staying on the body.
Yeah.
Spots and rashes and itches.
Yes.
I just had all of them. Randomly. Very itchy skin. For no apparent reason. And I started getting spots. And I'm guessing that is because hormones start firing up and changes and stuff. And yeah, I got a lot of spots and just unexplained rashes just appeared, disappeared.
Yeah, I wonder what's that from. I agree with the spots. I did too. I think it is all your hormones just actually changing and firing up and getting into balance again. I guess with the skin, there'll be some biologist who would be able to tell us what's going on. But again, your body's changing, isn't it?
Yes. And I guess people get rashes and stuff from foods that they have an intolerance to. And I kind of feel that when you start recovery from a high level of restriction, your body doesn't have much of a tolerance to anything because it's not been practicing tolerating anything.
Yeah, that's a good point. So it could be linked to that as well, just your body getting used to the food as well as the changes that's going on.
Yeah, like histamine reactions to
having
food, different foods, and your body just having to work so hard to adapt.
Yeah, because histamine, and I found this out last, I think, a couple of years ago, because I get, not so much now, but I used to have quite bad hay fever. So in the summer, it used to get worse, obviously. And then my husband, he's doing his usual research because he's obsessed with research and all of that kind of stuff, as you know why. And so we found out that, guess what is high in histamine? Chocolate's high in histamine. Yogurt is high in histamine. Tomatoes and some other stuff that we were eating. So your body can only tolerate so much till it has like a reaction to it. So because of the summer and the pollen, you've already got so much histamine stuff going on, and then you eat high histamine foods, that's when you have like constant sneezing and reactions because your body can't handle it. So that's really interesting that you mentioned histamine with rashes as well. That would make sense.
Yeah. So that was my theory.
Yeah, and also menstrual cycle. I mean, I've not got that on my list, but I know if you want to share your experience, but mine was I didn't have a period for years and years and years and years. And then when it came back, it started to be very sporadic. So I'd like have a period, then I'd be like, yay, it's back. And then I'd be like, well, where's it gone? Then it would just be all over the place until it gradually started to get its own rhythm. So I don't know if you want to talk about where you're at.
Oh, well, mine's way more confusing because I didn't have a period for over 20 years. And then I had one about probably 8 months into recovery, 8, 9 months, that was really short and light. And then I've had no more, but I'm 49.
Yeah.
I may or may not be in perimenopause or menopause. So I'm actually currently going through blood tests and stuff to try and find out where I am hormonally, because I don't know at all where I am. I suspect it's got a lot to do with my age and the menopause as well. So yeah, that's just quite a confusing one for me.
Yeah, I would say intuitively what came to me when you did have that small period in recovery, this is just a Victoria way of thinking, but I would say your body was like, hey, just so you know, like we're on the right path to recovery. Like this is what, you know, a healthy woman's body is starting to look like. And we're also getting to premenopause. So it was also like, just so you know, like it's almost like a cheerleading kind of from your body. That's just weirdly what came to me when you were sharing that.
That's a lovely way of thinking of it. I'll go with that.
Yeah. Well, who knows? Okay. I would like to go into, so things that are probably, well, yeah, it does still fit under this title, shit that people don't talk about. You know when, and I know you had a great mindset before you even started recovery about weight gain, but for me, things got way worse before they got better because I was weight restoring, but I wasn't mentally rewired from an eating disorder yet. So it was like I was in this fatter body with all the stuff going on. I was being in food freedom, yet I still had a restrictive eating disorder in my mind. So it was almost like it was easier and better to be in the eating disorder, but there was almost like no going back. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And my response to that is, I mean, I went into it saying it's do or die.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get fat. And that's
what I loved about your outlook, because it really supported you though, didn't it?
Yes, I guess it did. But also, I had an amazing coach who really helped me from the very beginning with the mindset stuff, with the acceptance. And so I was doing that alongside weight restoration rather than doing all the weight restoration first. I was doing it all at the same time. So I had a fantastic coach, and that's also how I coach.
Thank you. And that coach is me, for those that don't know. If you can't see the video, if you're watching the podcast, I'm there like blushing in the background, like praying hands saying thank you. But it's really true, isn't it? And that's how we both coach now, because when I started recovery, I didn't have me as a coach.
No.
I had coaches, but you know, for like I had like a spiritual intuitive eating coach, but who was actually still very much in diet related mentality, which I know now, which I didn't at the time. Then I had like a life coach. So I had like different coaches, and I put like everything together myself, which made sense, because so many people, and I know you've experienced this with clients that have come to you as well, Julia, they've been in recovery before. They've quote weight restored and they've relapsed again like three times. They've been in inpatient treatment, come out, gone back. And then they've done it like three or four times, relapse. And that's because we're not looking at the absolute root cause of the eating disorder. people are looking at the behaviors, which makes sense because they need to eat and nourish. But then if you're not healing the root, the branches are just going to grow again.
Absolutely. But there is also the side of it that when you are really undernourished, your brain capacity is not good and it's really hard to do the other work. So you have to do both at the same time. You can't do, or at least I certainly couldn't have done the self-acceptance work, all the mental work without eating properly, because I didn't have capacity to think.
And that's the hardest part, isn't it? Starting, gaining weight, still working through all the mindset stuff, or only just starting to understand what it takes to rewire the fear. And obviously, it's not just mindset, as you know, it's trauma release, it's inner child stuff, it's body image work, it's self-love work, it's all of this holistic approach. That for me, it was really work bad at the beginning because I didn't have any of that. And so it was almost like I wish I was back in the restrictive eating disorder because I was just happier. But this is why it's so worth pushing through. It's
So
so worth pushing through.
it's so worth getting a coach that will do all that work with you.
Coaching, I mean, this is why we're both coaches, right? Coaching is life-changing.
So life-changing.
Therapy is great, and I'm not slating therapy at all. I've had therapists throughout my life, and some of them have been helpful, but they don't work in the same way. They're not messaging you, in between sessions. They're not like sending you, oh, listen to this, watch that. I'm thinking of you. I'm gonna that it's just such a incredible relationship you build between a client and a coach that, in my experience anyway, I've never even got close to with a therapist that I've been to.
No, my own take on it is that therapy helps you sift through all the stuff in your head and helps you make sense of it. Coaching does that and empowers you to start taking control of your own life and being your own best friend.
So it's both and, isn't it? If you're a really good, because coach, there's no one, there's no, oh, the word again, there's no kind of authority, which isn't the word I'm looking for. Looking, what did you say?
Governing body.
Governing body, that's exactly what I wanted. Thank you. There's no governing bodies there being like that you need to have this, you need to, which can be a blessing and a curse depending on what kind of what coach you want, what experience you have. So we use NLP, trauma release, CBT, intuitive mentoring and coaching. We can basically do what we want from what we've learned that has helped us and bring it into our coaching practice. Whereas a therapist, they're very closely governed and monitored and watched a lot as well. So there's boundaries that they're not allowed to cross.
Yes, I also think that more coaches have got lived experience, which for me, eating disorder recovery is everything because you get it.
Totally. It's not just understanding intellectually. It's
Yeah, you felt it.
And there's nothing like someone who says to you, I really understand how you feel right now, and I'm with you through this, and this is how I got through exactly what you're going through, and you will too.
Yeah. Or that person is celebrating you for eating a biscuit because it was a fear food, when to the rest of the world, eating a biscuit's no big deal. But when you've been terrified of them and restricted them, it's huge and it needs to be celebrated.
Yes. It's the understanding, isn't it? Like someone who has never experienced an eating disorder and come out the other side, when someone's trying to describe to someone who's never had an eating disorder about the fear of weight gain, because that person doesn't understand it, they will never be able to just hold the space of just pure listening and understanding. They'll try to and they'll do their best. But unless someone has been in a position where at points I would have rather literally died than gain weight because I was petrified, other than someone just being like, yeah, no one likes to gain weight. But there's just such a big difference between the two. So I think it's a really relevant point.
Yeah.
What else is running on this?
Still on the body, because I've got some non-body things as well, but still on the body is unexplained pains. It's like shooting pains. And I got something I can only describe as it felt like somebody was knitting my bones.
Oh.
Just particularly in my legs and in my thighs, it felt like my bones were being knitted. And yeah, just really unexplained and random pains, which I don't know the medical answer to in my head.
Yeah.
The Julia thoughts are that that is my bones being rebuilt.
Yeah. Because they needed to be, because they were probably brittle as.
Yeah.
I think that's really brittle.
It's feeling the repair work going on.
Yeah. Wow.
That's my thoughts, and I'm going to stick to them.
I like them because intuitively they're the right answer for you anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So I did have a lot of unexplained pains and stuff.
Think
and I just
that I had inflammation, like in joints and stuff, inflammation, but it's just all part of the healing and repairs, isn't it?
Yes.
I know we're going to talk about next, I think, which I didn't experience, but I think, and another client of mine did, and I put her to you, didn't I? If what you're going to talk about next is what I'm guessing.
What are we going to talk about next?
Restless leg syndrome.
No, I haven't put that on my list, but yeah, really good one.
Because I didn't experience that. So do you want to share what, because I didn't hear about it until you shared with me, and then I did my own research and I was like, I think it's this.
Yeah, so I got very, very fidgety legs, particularly when I was sat down in the evenings and very much at night. My legs, I got to the point where I would just want to cry in the night because I couldn't go to sleep because my legs would not settle and I just had to keep moving them, even though I was so, so tired. And quite often I couldn't even stay lying down. I'd have to just get up and walk around because that was just what my legs made me do. And it was a nightmare. It was awful. A couple of things really, really helped. Having more iron in my diet, and I had some supplements for iron because I was very low. But the biggest thing that helped was realizing that it was actually a hunger signal.
Oh, making you go and find food.
Yeah, it was. I was hungry. So when I had restless legs, if I had a snack, they stopped and I could go to sleep.
So interesting.
Yeah. So not all hunger signals are like tummy rumbling and stuff.
It's when your legs have got a mind of their own.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I had to eat in the night a lot, and I had little packs of biscuits next to the bed so that I could not have to go searching for food in the night. And yeah, every time I woke up with restless legs, having a snack stopped it and I could go back to sleep. So it's a very random hunger signal.
Yeah, because I never experienced nighttime eating either. I think because I had the binges along the way, which was always evening, to be fair. It was always at night. It wasn't late night, but it was always like, you know, around 7, 8, 9 o'clock. I would eat that much, like I said, till I physically couldn't breathe. And I used to message my cousin because we used to binge together because, of course, she wasn't in a restrictive eating disorder like I used to be, but she was a chronic dieter. So we would binge together because it feels better and there's less shame when you do it together. And would go separate ways, and I'd be in bed and I'd be messaging her, like, because I do still love humor and I do heal with humor, but I also used humor to deflect my shame. So I'll be messaging her like, I'm so full, it feels like my tummy's touching the ceiling, because it like literally felt like. And so we would laugh about stuff, but really underneath it all, none of it was laughable.
Yeah,
so that's just a random thing I wanted to share.
I have actually got shame on my list.
Oh, let's talk about that, because I've got quite a few left. We might be able to fit them in. Let's start with shame, because I say the very root, there's a few things underneath shame, which is childhood stuff, but then the outcome of that is a shitload of shame.
Yeah, and the shame at my body changing. was just horrendous. And with that shame came isolation. And I stopped going out and seeing people because I thought they would be disgusted at me.
Yeah.
And that was really hard.
Which is why, again, having a coach or someone in your corner even.
Yeah, very much so. And learning that where the shame is really coming from, and the fear of not being accepted and the fear of not being loved. And also noticing people, just looking at all the different body shapes and sizes out there and realizing that actually everybody's different and that's okay.
Yeah.
And that made a huge difference, just noticing other people's bodies, not like rudely staring or anything like that, just noticing, not saying anything, not making any judgments, just becoming much more aware. Because I think, and I don't know if this is the same for everybody, but certainly for me, within the eating disorder and early recovery, I was so in my own head and about me that I didn't really notice other people. I just judged me all the time.
Yeah, I was exactly the same. I was obsessed with myself, but in the least obsessive way possible. But it is, you're in bed with the eating disorder.
Yeah.
So wherever I would go, I would scan the room, like your anxiety would scan the room, and I'd be like, am I the thinnest one? And if I was, I'd be like, oh, phew.
Yeah,
definitely.
It's
like I was safe if I was the thinnest one.
Yeah, you just looked around so that you could negatively compare yourself.
Yes. And if someone was thinner than me, or what I perceive to be thinner than me, because there's body dysmorphia on my list as well, or if someone was perceived prettier than me, which is ridiculous and very self-centered, but it's trauma, I would be so anxious, and I would be angry as well. Like, how dare someone be thinner and prettier, which is ridiculous. But because survival to me was being, because it all links down to not being accepted or unconditionally loved as a child, that linking to needing to look a certain way in order to be safe, accepted and loved manifested in the behaviors of scanning the room, making sure I was the thinnest or at least as pretty as that other person, because that to me, that was a matter of life or death. And with what you said about shame, I've actually written down here the shame of being human, meaning, you know, we're a human. We have to eat, drink, go to the toilet, sleep. For some reason, and I guess this is linked to the anorexia and childhood stuff, I didn't want to, it wasn't like I didn't want to be human, because those words don't fit what I felt, but it was almost like, again, superiority, like I was different to everybody else, and I didn't want to have to engage in normal human behaviors. Like, did you feel anything like that?
Yes, very much so. Even down to using a public toilet. I didn't want to ever use a public toilet.
Yes.
I shouldn't have to.
Yes, the same. That's so weird.
Control not to do that. And I think it was a lot of control, actually.
Yeah. It's bizarre, isn't it? I'm just thinking back to, it was almost like, it's so hard to describe how I remember feeling. It's not like I wanted to commit suicide. I know that you did get to that point where you were planning that. I didn't get to the point where I was like planning my own death. But for most of my life, until I chose recovery, I was trying to avoid living.
Yeah. Just
which
exist.
Is just existing. But then I didn't want that. It's just so hard to put into words. It was like, I mean, from a spiritual sense, I've looked into this, and it kind of makes sense to me a little bit. You want to be so out of your body and more in the spirit world as you're experiencing human life, but you don't want to be fully a physical human with all, I think here's the word, with the human needs to be a burden, to need to eat food, to need to drink, to need the toilet, to need to go to bed. It's like, it's almost like I felt like a burden to have a need, which was human.
Feel like a weakness, or did.
Yes, weakness. Yeah.
To have to need felt like a weakness.
Yes, that's so true. That's mad, isn't it? And I can't really have an explanation for that, apart from childhood stuff.
Yeah, and probably just the way the eating disorder and survival response warps the brain.
Yeah. Like, God forbid you would, like, need a blanket or need the toilet or need food.
Yeah.
And I guess that's linked to worthiness as well, like not feeling worthy of even asking for a need to be met.
Hugely, hugely linked to that.
Yeah, so the less human we are, the less needs we have. Wow. Okay, what else is on your...
An inability to focus on anything.
In recovery or during the eating disorder, or both?
Both, but early recovery, it was really, really heightened. I couldn't read a book for more than a couple of pages. I'd just be going back over it again and again and again. And I couldn't watch telly because my mind was wandering all over the place. I couldn't make a decision. That was really hard. Like, I knew I had to eat, but I didn't know what to eat. I didn't know what I wanted.
Yeah.
And that was so, so hard to make the decisions and to have what I wanted. And you actually suggested to me to go back to what I used to have as a child and what I used to like as a child. And that was really helpful. And the other thing that you said, which was amazingly helpful, was to toss a coin. And if, say, heads meant crisps and tails meant biscuits, and if it landed on tails, and if I was like, oh, then I knew I wanted the crisps.
Yes.
But if it landed on tails and I was like, yes, then I knew I really wanted the biscuits.
Yeah.
So that was a really helpful thing.
I think that's allowing yourself permission to have a want again or a preference.
Yes. Yes, I guess it is.
Because I remember you, because this is how I love, like, we're both the same, but so different in our recoveries. Because I remember coaching you and you genuinely didn't like food. Whereas yeah, I used to love food, even with the restriction, the binging, I generally love food. So, and I remember saying to you, and I think I messaged you a couple of weeks ago speaking to this, when I said to you, remember when you thought you would, if you would ever like food again in your entire life? And I was like, you will get pleasure out of food at some point. And now you do.
Yeah, but I didn't believe that would ever happen.
You didn't believe it.
I could just take a pill that would meet my nutritional needs and be done with it and never have to eat again.
Yeah. So I think, can you go into more depth? Because I think that's quite common that I've not had this experience, direct experience with, meaning that you're in recovery. Of course you want to eat, you need to eat, you're going to choose to eat. But what the hell do you eat when you generally have no desire? I think that's the word, isn't it? Desire to eat something.
Yeah. I mean, you said there, of course you want to eat. I did not want to eat. I ate because I had to.
Yeah. But you wanted recovery.
Yes.
Well, yes, good point. You don't, of course, you don't want to eat. Yeah.
Okay. So, sorry, can you go back to what the question was you just asked?
Yeah. So, I think you didn't have a desire. So, obviously, you were choosing recovery. You didn't want to eat, but you know you had to. But there was no desire that you were trying to squish down. Like, there was no mental hunger yet where you were like, oh my God, I would just love to eat a jar of Nutella like I did. So, how did you navigate what to eat when you knew you were going to eat anyway because you had to?
By going back to foods I had as a child and having those, and it's just kind of thinking, well, what's a breakfast food at breakfast time that is going to give me as much energy as I can get from it, that I think I can tolerate, not necessarily physically tolerate, but mentally tolerate eating while still challenging myself.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't have been able to tolerate, say, a fried breakfast. That would have just taken me too far. I wouldn't.
Yeah.
That was panic, complete panic. So I think I had porridge. I know I had porridge. I cried over porridge every day.
You did.
And I used to put lots of like granola and nuts and stuff on it to get extra fats and proteins and stuff to give my body more nutrients. So I kind of I suppose a little bit orthorexically, tried to give my body as many nutrients as I could with foods that I could just about manage without being completely panicked, but it was always a huge challenge. And a lot of things like Marmite sandwiches and bacon frazzles, which is what I had as a child. Yeah, just trying and things, trying to introduce things like adding a potato into dinner when I hadn't eaten carbs for years and stuff, and just trying to add things in. So I suppose before I started recovery, my only safe food was yogurt that I'd made myself from scratch, which I no longer do. And I actually avoided yogurt for a really long time in recovery because it felt like a sick food. I
Like
didn't eat yogurt
restricting
yet,
food.
yeah.
And so what I'm hearing is, and I think I would have suggested you do this anyway, as your coach at the time, you were using your intellect to guide you as to what to eat, fats, proteins, carbs, a bit of fiber, but not much because you were obviously in weight restoration, to choose what you were going to have in each meal. So it was using your intellect other than your body's cues.
I didn't have any body cues at that point.
Because you didn't. And again, in the anorexia, I didn't. And I was very much forced to the which I'm glad I was at the time, even though it was hot, the it was horrible. I was very much literally force-fed, so
Yeah,
I didn't
I didn't
really
have
have
to
to,
choose.
yeah, I didn't have to choose. So it was, in a way, it was worse, but it was easier.
Yeah. I also asked my family what they wanted for food as well.
So you could gauge from that as well. I would like to go into, have you got about 10 minutes?
Yeah, I'm good for
I have.
time.
Cool. Let me see what I want to speak to now. Right. I've spoken about feeling superior and the shame of being human. Two things that I would love to bring up, and you might not have an experience of this, but I think there'll still be something you can add. With the binges that I experienced, I used to miss, well, you both used to miss the high of restriction, but I used to miss the binges. So the binges were almost like, I've never taken drugs, but I would assume almost like such a high. I saw that smile. I've taken plant medicine. That is not drugs. Very recently, which was awesome. If anyone wants to know about that, then let us know, because I'm in the Netherlands, so I can talk legally about it. Let us know. We might do a, oh my God, that would be the most epic podcast ever. Maybe. To let us know if you want us to share this big thing that's not so much of a secret anymore, and we might do, which was massive for trauma healing. Anyway, with the binges, I planned them a lot of the time. So I would starve myself purposely. Then I would go to the shop and I'd be like, literally, like so excited and on like a high buying all this food. I would lie to the cashier because it was before self-checkout. Yeah, the girls are coming around. It was just for me. And I would sit and I'd have to be by myself, couldn't have anyone else around me. I mean, sometimes with my cousin, we would, but it wouldn't be to the extent that I would do this by myself. And then the second I started the binge, it was like this intense, exciting high. And then as you progress into food freedom, food cannot physically or emotionally give you that high anymore. It can't. And during recovery, I almost tried to try and get the high of food still, and I physically couldn't because I was weight restored and I wasn't mentally restricting anymore, and I felt safe that there was enough. So I don't say I miss it now, but it took a few years for me to stop missing the high of the binge. So I don't know if you can speak to that in terms of restriction, maybe.
I did miss the high from restriction a lot. And I guess that leads into one thing that I've got written down, which is grief. The grief of letting go of the identity and the world that you'd created around you. And part of what also I have written down is emotional overload of just randomly crying or I know some people feel really angry for no reason, and I think that's all part of the grief of letting go of that, of the highs from binging, of the highs from restriction, of the external validation for your body and your ability to, or certainly my ability to train crazy hours and be doing so much and stuff. And there was a whole identity that I built around that and around the eating disorder.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of grief. And I think that was why I had quite a lot of emotional overload. And also, when you stop restricting, you start feeling.
Absolutely. And the last thing, and I want to ask you more about that, but this just leads perfectly into the last thing I wanted to bring up. And that was, I've written down in Victoria fashion, other shit in your life starts to fuck up because restriction was a distraction from what was really going on. And so, like you said, when you stop restricting and you start recovering and healing, all of the stuff that you were suppressing from said restriction hits the fan. It comes to the surface and you're like, what the fuck is happening?
Yeah. And it is an emotional overload.
Yeah. And restriction was the best coping mechanism for that.
Yeah. So you have to learn some other ways of coping, which, I mean, when you say restriction was the best coping mechanism, it was until it wasn't.
Yeah.
Because it lost effectiveness, didn't it?
Yeah.
It got less and less. I would have to restrict more and more and more and do more and get thinner and thinner in order to have the same effects, which I imagine is very similar to a drug addiction. You have to take more and more.
Yes. Yeah.
So yeah, learning other coping mechanisms, learning that you can breathe.
And you can feel, and the worst, I can't remember where this quote came from, and I really wish that I could, so I could like give this person praise. This quote really changed my life. The worst thing that will ever happen to me is I will feel a feeling.
Yes.
And yes, feelings can be very overwhelming and painful, but it's just a feeling.
Yeah, and the fear of feeling the feeling is much, much worse and much, much harder than just allowing the feeling and feeling it.
It is, isn't it? I loved it when you said that in your podcast with your hubby, wasn't it? With Dave, would you say that, I think
I've said it a few times.
Yeah, and then I think you said in one episode that you did with Dave, it really stuck with me and I commented on it. You said something like, what I thought I was in control of was actually controlling me.
Yes.
With the eating disorder and the restriction.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, going back to feelings, it is. It sounds, I mean, I used to think it sounded boring, but that was just my mask to try and protect myself from actually sitting with feelings. But if you learn to do that, your life will never be the same again in the most beautiful way possible, to just sit with a feeling, write about it. If you feel like you need to do something, I used to write mine down because at least I felt like I was technically, quote, doing something, but I was still feeling. So I was writing about what I was feeling, or just breathing and feeling.
I've always found it really, really helpful to notice where in my body I was feeling the feeling and kind of give it a shape and give it a colour. And just try and identify what it is. Is it fear? Is it anger? Is it sadness? Is it grief? And then just breathe and create the space with my breath around the feeling, just so that it can be there and have space to be there. And after just a few breaths, it just kind of seemed to fizzle away.
Yeah. And then you get evidence like, wait, I can feel my feeling without being overwhelmed and running away from it and then going back to restriction or binging or whatever I need to do to get away from myself, which you never can, because wherever you go, there you are.
Yeah. I mean, I never would have believed it, but actually feeling the feelings is so much easier than avoiding them.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I'm so with you on that. And I could speak more because we have to go, but one tiny quick thing, body dysmorphia is a thing. And even for both of us now, I mean, we're both healed. We both love and accept who we are, our bodies, no matter what they look like, which is the part, one of the key parts of recovery. But you and I, when we were together, when we spent that beautiful time together, I think we both noticed that just through general comments, lovingly, that you think you're bigger than you are. And I think I'm bigger than I am, not in a negative way, but just in the way we perceive ourselves.
Yes.
So what we did, so shall I share the exercise we did in case someone else wants to do that with their loved ones? So what me and Julia did is I said, so when we recognized this with each other, we were like, okay, well, let's do something about this. There's nothing wrong with it because we love and accept who we are. That's a key point, right? Like I said, but it can be helpful with the healing of the body dysmorphia to actually have a loved one who you trust, like you was mine and mine was yours. And for them to choose, was it three people? Was it about three people?
One each, didn't we?
Just one each. One person on Instagram or wherever, it doesn't have to be Instagram, what you think represents that person's body the most. But this is a further along thing in recovery to do because it doesn't matter because you accept yourself anyway.
Yeah, you sent me one that you thought your body looked like.
Yes.
And one that you thought my body looked like.
That was
and
it.
And I did it for you.
Yeah.
And the ones we chose for ourselves were much bigger than the ones we chose for each other.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And I think just generally, we don't see ourselves as other people see us.
Mm. Yeah.
There's as a society.
Yeah, I agree. There's still maybe some healing work to do. Again, I've repeated this. This is the third time now. It doesn't matter because we love and accept ourselves. But it was just an interesting exercise when you sent.
Very interesting, yeah.
Yeah, when you sent me the video of the woman you thought I looked like, I was actually shocked, actually, which was just a weird feeling. So if you have someone who you love and trust, and you're partway into, you know, at least a couple of months into recovery, I think that can be a beneficial exercise, don't you?
Yes, definitely. I think it was really beneficial, actually.
Yeah.
Because it just shows that people are unnecessarily seeing themselves in a different light from how everybody else sees them, from what reality is, that we don't see ourselves as we are.
Yeah, that's so true. It's our warped reality that we live in because we create our own reality from all the past trauma around body image and restriction and needing to be good enough. We, even through the healing from mine and yours experiences, we don't see ourselves as others truly see us. And that was just really interesting exercise to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. This is going to be a regular occurrence, I'm sure, because I love chatting with you. There's so much that we can share. Is there anything else we want to add before we say goodbye?
Well, I don't know. The only other thing I've got on here was sex drive.
Oh, yes. You had a draft and then a flood, literally.
That was bizarre. I had no idea, and nobody talks about it. Nobody talks about it whatsoever. So obviously in the eating disorder, I didn't really have a sex drive at all. And I'm not surprised really when I think about it, because why would my body want to think about reproduction when it was starving?
Yes.
And then in recovery, I wouldn't even consider letting my husband see me without clothes on, because I was mortified by my body, by the changes. And because for me, I got the edema, and so the changes happened very, very quickly, I was so ashamed. And I also still didn't have any desire, so I had no sex drive. And then I suppose, what about 4 or 5 months into recovery, my sex drive returned with like all the years of missing sex drive at once. Like hit by a freight train of randiness. And it was terrifying and liberating.
I remember when you said, I'm driving down to my husband, because he was in London, wasn't he?
He was.
And I was like, this is epic. I was like, let me know how it goes without giving me details, obviously, but I'm so excited for it to hear how that went.
But it was surprising and terrifying and amazing to actually want, which I hadn't done for so long. But it does, and I have since discovered it's quite common that your sex drive will return all at once.
Because your body's got everything it needs to then focus on something else.
And my poor husband was exhausted.
He wasn't complaining, though.
There were a couple of times he was like, no, I'm tired.
Not again. Oh my God, that's epic. And really quickly, my experience with that was, for me, it was always more body shame. So yes, I didn't have a sex drive when I was obviously underweight for my weight, which was most of my life, but I was very much putting on a show as well. I was very much looking for love through sex with men. So I was just faking everything. I didn't even know what I was or what I wanted. But when I was in a loving relationship, I was just hiding because I was so ashamed of what my body looked like. And then because I had so much anxiety around what I thought he would think of me, I couldn't relax. Relaxation is the gateway to pleasure. I couldn't receive pleasure. I could fake pleasure, but I couldn't receive it because I wasn't relaxed. So for me, it was a lot of body image stuff that helped me to now to be able to have a beautiful, intimate sex life and just be in my body, not me worrying about what he's thinking of my body.
Yeah.
So there you go. I think we've got another part two coming on, haven't we? So if anyone has... Give us a title and we will talk about it.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, give us a title or a question that we can speak to and we will do it. Even if we do it, you know, every other week or something and have it as extra bonuses for our podcast. I'm really cool with that.
Yeah, it's fun. It's great fun. Yeah. Doing an episode together. I love it.
I love it too. So let us know questions or titles for us both to speak to. And look out for us releasing them again soon. So I have a call in 4 minutes. I'm going to have to shoot. So I love you, Julia. You know that. Thank you for
thank you so much.
Thank you for your wisdom, your time.
Thank you. And thank you to all the listeners.
Indeed. And we will see you again soon. Yeah. Much love.